Okay, it's a very quick introduction. A pleasure to welcome Dr. Shai Sukundan, making his debut on Torah Motion. A pleasure to have you, as you heard, speaking from Modi'in. He's a Jacob Neusner Professor of Judaism at Bard College, and we're moving religions from Islam to Zoroastrianism, and he is the world's expert in the field. Wrote the book, The Iranian Talmud, Reading the Bavli and Sassanian Context, and it's a pleasure to have you speak about the Persian influences on the Talmud. Bakasha.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me, Rabbi Kelman, and it's good to see faces, to see names, and to be able to learn a little bit on at least what for you is a legal holiday. I want to take the opportunity to talk about a little bit of background. Let me just get my PowerPoint going, and then we will. Can everybody see the PowerPoint okay? Yes,
Yes,
excellent.
we see fine. Thank you.
So the topic of what I want to talk about today is the Talmud's encounter with Zoroastrianism. I'll say just a couple of words of introduction to explain the title, because on the one hand, we have a religion, which I believe is the theme of today's Yom Iyun, Judaism's encounters with the world, including various religions like Islam. On the other hand, we have the Talmud, which is not a religion, but rather a book, a very important book, obviously, or a set of books. And the reason for this is that the Talmud is our best source for thinking about how Judaism, how our tradition encounters this other tradition, Zoroastrianism. So I'll be toggling between talking about the Talmud, talking about the Babylonian Talmud, especially, in order to say something a little deeper and more profound about Jews, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism, an ancient Iranian religion that we'll get to know in the next few minutes. Let me set the stage with a little bit of geography. This is a map of much of the Jewish world in what we call late antiquity, essentially from this around the second to the seventh or eighth centuries of the Common Era. You can see in the bottom right corner, one very important place and one almost as important place. The very important place, of course, is Jerusalem and Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. If you can see my cursor there. And then further east and a little bit further north, we have Babylonia. These are the two centers, Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael. Actually, not so much Jerusalem, but a little bit further north in the Galilee, in the Galilee, where the rabbis, both in Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, gave us essentially the books, the works that are at the very center of not only our bookshelf, but the way we think, the way we live our lives, the way we practice Judaism. And in particular, the Jews in Babylonia, the rabbis in Babylonia gave us the Babylonian Talmud, which is the nerve center of the Jewish tradition. Now, one of the things we need to think about when we're thinking about Babylonia is politics. Who was in charge? With whom did the Jews come into contact? And especially in the theme of today's Yom Iyun, which religion or religions were prominent in the region? So I want to begin first with basic politics. I want to do it in a colorful way. Politically, while in Eretz Yisrael, the Jews, the Chachamim, the rabbis were under Roman rule, in Bavel, in Babylonia, they were under a Iranian regime that came from southwestern Persia, and they were known as the Sasanians. The Sasanians came to power at the beginning of the third century, around 224, 226 of the Common Era. And there's a parade of kings, very powerful kings that we know about through historical sources, including also the Talmud. So just for example, in the source that I have at the top, which comes from a Masechet Sukkah, we have a colorful depiction of one of the most prominent Amoraim, early rabbis of the Amoraic period, Shmuel, who would juggle in front of King Shapur with 8 cups of wine. Okay, this is part of a discussion of what's known as the Simchat Bein HaShoeivah, this great festival that took place on the holiday of Sukkot in the Beit HaMikdash, but even afterwards. And the Talmud uses the opportunity to talk about various people dancing, performing in front of their masters. In the case of Shmuel, who lived at the beginning of the 3rd century, he danced in front of the second Sasanian king, King Shapur, with 8 cups of wine. And I brought a kind of some colorful artifacts that give us a sense of the culture and what this looked like. On the left is the coin of King Shapur, and on the right is an artifact in which a dancer is dancing with torches. Part of the very performative aspect of the Sasanian court. Now, I want to draw your attention to not this beautiful picture of King Shapur, but the other side of the coin. And if we look on the other side of the coin, what we see are two priests, Zoroastrian priests, as the case may have it. And in the middle, we have an altar. On top of that altar is fire. This is a great entry point in a way of appreciating the relationship between the Sasanian kings and the Sasanian Empire, again, the dominant regime in Babylonia, and the religion that they were aligned with, which was Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism is a priestly religion, which means that much of the kind of energy in the religion is not sort of grassroots, private ceremonies, but rather there's a lot centered in a priestly hierarchy. And in particular, the main mode of worship, which we're going to hear about a little bit more from passages in the Talmud, is fire. Fire was seen as this great symbol for the religion. It was seen as some kind of manifestation of their god, Ahura Mazda or Mazd. And because of that, the Sasanian kings thought it was important enough to put on the obverse, on the opposite side of their coins, a fire altar flanked by two priests. Now, let me say a little bit more about Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism, of course, emphasizes worship of fire. It has a priestly hierarchy. It is also extremely old. Some of the oldest texts that we have in readable language are the Avesta, which is essentially the Zoroastrian scriptures. And the oldest core of the Avesta might go back as far as the second millennium BC. So we're talking about extremely old texts. And this religion seems to have begun in parts of Central Asia, migrates towards the Iranian plateau, and over the course of time moves further west, moves further south, so that it's established in places like Babylonia, like Babel, and because of that, Jews come into contact with Zoroastrianism. So they come into contact through Zoroastrian kings. They also come into Zoroastrianism through Zoroastrian priests. Now, I want to talk a little bit about persecution. Unfortunately, whenever we think about Judaism and other religions, one of the things we need to think about is the persecution that Jews experience in their encounter with other religions. And unfortunately, that was the case when it came to Zoroastrianism. So at the bottom of this slide, you can see an image of a figure making a kind of gesture. This is a 3rd century Zoroastrian priest named Kerdir, who commissioned to have inscriptions. These are actually monumental, it looks small, but gigantic inscriptions inscribed on the faces of rocks throughout their empire. What he does in this inscription is what anyone would do in an inscription like this. He boasts, he brags, he talks about all his accomplishments. Part of the inscription even looks like a CV. It's like, I started with this king and I had this, I was at this level and then I moved up and I advanced. And I built this many altars and I did this many sacrifices. And also, I persecuted various peoples. So the part that I want to read very briefly with you, both will show us that Jews were one of the religious communities that apparently came under Kurdir's persecutions. But it also gives us a little bit more of a sense of what the religion looked like. I'll read this from the top. So, and this is just an excerpt from the larger inscription. And from province to province, place to place, and throughout the empire, the services to Ormazd, this is the main prominent god in Zoroastrianism, and the gods increased. And the Mazdaiasnian, meaning the Zoroastrian tradition, and the Magi, the Zoroastrian priests, received great honor in the empire, and great satisfaction came to the gods, water, fire, and cattle in the empire. This already tells us that beyond, again, his desire to boast, he also gives us a window into some of the values and some of the things that were considered to be sacred in Zoroastrianism. Number one, we have the prominent god Ormazd, who's associated with good, as we'll later see. We also have other gods, other spiritual forces that they also worshipped. And also, a number of elements were seen as sacred, as holy, and had to be protected. This includes things like water, like fire, which we already saw in the obverse of that coin, cattle, and in other texts, we also hear about righteous people who are also seen as sacred. The text then continues, and great blows and harm came to Ahriman and the demons. So the other side of things, and as we'll see, Zoroastrianism puts a great emphasis on a dualism that divides the world into good and evil. On the one hand, you have Ormazd, the good god, and on the other hand, you have Ahriman, the evil god, who has his minions, which are demons. So Kurdir sees his effort, sees his task as giving blows and harm to this evil force, and similarly to the evil beliefs that are associated with this evil force, and the belief of Ahriman and the demons exited the empire and was made untrustworthy. And then he gives us a list of religious communities that also were seen as associated with the wrong side, which he also struck. And this is important for us because the number one religion in his list is Jews, right? He writes, and Jews and shamans and Brahmins and Nazarenes and Christians. These seem to be two different communities of Christians. And Baptists, meaning people, a group, perhaps the Mandeans, who placed great emphasis on immersion in water and purification, and Manichaeans, another dualistic religion, were struck in the empire, and idols were destroyed, and the dens of the demons were destroyed and made into thrones and seats of the gods. Not only that, there were many who believed in the demons, meaning in these negative religions, but I managed to have them give up the faith in the demons and receive the faith in the good gods. In the gods. So in other words, here we have a Zoroastrian priest, not a king like Shapur, but someone who served under kings like Shapur. He served for many, many years, actually, who was, we could say, much more strident in his relationship with other religious communities in the empire, including Jews, and he seems to have persecuted them. So one thing that's nice to do is to sort of contrast this image where we have Shmuel dancing in front of King Shapur, clearly respecting him and thinking that he was more or less a good king. So a more or less good relationship with Sasanian kings who were Zoroastrian, and a Zoroastrian priest like Kurdir who boasts of persecuting the Jews. Now, I don't want to spend the whole time on persecution, but I do want to just cite one Talmudic source that confirms the fact that it wasn't always easy for the Jews. This is a Gemara from Tractate Yevamot, from Masechet Yevamot, which applies a biblical verse to various bad actors, let's call them, including Zoroastrians. So I just gave you a little excerpt here, and it goes like this. The verse says, with a foolish nation, I will anger them. Rabbi Yochanan said, these are the Zoroastrian priests. They said to Rabbi Yochanan, the Zoroastrian priests have come to Babylonia. Rabbi Yochanan lived in the 3rd century. He lived actually at the time when the Sasanian Empire came and established themselves. And some have argued that they brought in kind of a renewed energy for Zoroastrianism. So even though Zoroastrian priests had lived in Babylonia beforehand, it's possible that in the 3rd century, suddenly there was more energy that these Zoroastrian priests had. And because of that, he leaned over and fell. He did not take the news well. They said to him, they accept bribes, and Rabbi Yochanan sat up straight. So you can see already the beginnings of a realpolitik that Jews have used at various moments, difficult moments in history. On the one hand, Rabbi Yochanan seems to see this as a threat coming from the Zoroastrians. On the other hand, as soon as he realizes that they're not entirely ideological, there are ways of softening things, of making things work, he's able to sit up straight. The next line in the Gemara really does seem to correspond to that persecution that Kurdir, the high Zoroastrian priest, boasts of. It says that they decreed regarding 3 things for 3 sins. Okay, and what I want you to see when we read this sentence is we have a couple of things going on. On the one hand, we have a description that's based on the old Jewish idea of midah kenegan midah, meaning that one is punished, the nation is punished, particularly according to their sins. So that if they committed a certain type of sin, so the punishment will fit the crime, let's call it. And that's one way of reading this text. So I'll read it in that vein, and then I'll open up a little bit more to exactly why the Zoroastrians would persecute the Jews in this way. They decreed regarding meat because of negligence in tithing the priestly gifts. There is an area of halakha not practiced anymore, but it was practiced even by some Jews in Bavel after the Beis Hamikdash, after the temple was destroyed. And that is that one is supposed to give a portion of meat to the priests, to the Kohanim. When you slaughter an animal, you don't eat all of it. Even the kosher parts, you can't eat all of it. You have to give some of it to the Kohanim. The Jews apparently were negligent in fulfilling this mitzvah. And on account of that, there was a punishment where they, apparently the Zoroastrian priests, maybe the Sasanians, made a decree that no one's having any more meat. Jews are not going to be able to eat meat anymore. That's number one. Number two, they decreed regarding the bathhouses because of negligence and immersion. Judaism requires ritual immersion at various points, particularly women when they finish their period to become pure again. Babylonian Jews, the Talmud tells us, were negligent in this matter. So on account of that, the authorities closed all the bathhouses so that no one can immerse, no one can wash themselves, and they also won't be able to fulfill this mitzvah that they already had been negligent in. Lastly, they dig up corpses because the Jews are happy on the day of their festivals, meaning there are days that one is not supposed to be joyous, one is not supposed to transact with Gentiles. We'll see an example of this just in a few minutes. Nevertheless, the Jews in Babylonia celebrated to a certain extent these Persian festivals. And as a result, because they were happy, they were forced to be sad. This is the midah keneged midah, the measure that they had to dig up the corpses. They had to exhume relatives that had been buried. So again, one way of reading this text is Jews were negligent in one area of halakha, in one area of Jewish law, and as a result, they were punished in a fitting way by the authorities, right? The Persians or the Zoroastrian priests were sort of God's instrument for punishing the Jews. But I think you can also read this text at another level, which again gives us insight into Zoroastrianism and into the Jewish encounter with Zoroastrianism. Let's look at the first thing. They decreed regarding meat because of negligence in the priestly gifts. We know that Zoroastrians were very much opposed to slaughtering animals. They were not vegetarians, but as we saw in Kyrgios' inscription, they were very respectful of cattle, of meat. One had to treat meat properly. One had to treat the animals properly. And in their view, the way to prepare meat for consumption, the way to kill the animals was through strangulation. That was seen as the proper way of doing it. And we even have texts that describe the fact that the Jews slaughter as highly problematic from a Zoroastrian perspective. So, yes, the Talmud is telling us that this was a punishment for a divine punishment for the Jews not being careful about this area of halakha, but it also works with Zoroastrian sensitivities. They were against slaughter, Jews slaughter, and therefore they banned the slaughter of meat. Number two, they closed all the bathhouses. We also know from a number of texts that Zoroastrians were very careful about water and its sanctity. We saw that actually in Kurdir's inscription. And also, they didn't like bathhouse culture, which was very popular in late antiquity, including in the Roman Empire, the neighboring Roman Empire. So in Eretz Israel, if you've ever toured around just about anywhere, but say Caesarea, you will see these elaborate bathhouses. And part of the culture was going, schwitzing, washing, using water to cleanse oneself and to feel good. The Zoroastrians were opposed to this. And as a result, a number of texts talk about them closing bathhouses. So again, here too, it seems that there's a Zoroastrian sensitivity that lies behind this text. Finally, the last line, which is so unusual, why would Jews be forced to dig up corpses? From a Zoroastrian perspective, we actually have echoes of this elsewhere in the Talmud and also in other non-Jewish sources, that Zoroastrians, not only do they consider water to be sacred, fire to be sacred, cattle to be sacred, they also consider the earth to be sacred. And as a result, they thought that after a person dies, they should not be buried in the earth, but rather their body should be disposed of in another way. In the picture on the left, there's actually, it's an image of a fascinating place. I don't know if anyone's traveled to India, been to Bombay. It's not really in use in the way that it used to be for a variety of fascinating reasons. But this is known as the Tower of Silence. Many Zoroastrians made it to India, especially to Bombay, already as far back as the 9th century. They established themselves as a community, and they built something called a Tower of Silence, which is a way of disposing of the dead so that it does not contaminate the earth. Not to get too gruesome, they lay out the bodies in this tower. Birds, used to be dogs, but primarily birds, would consume the body, and then the bones would be buried separately. Right. So again, this Zoroastrian sensitivity about the purity of a number of elements, including the ground, might stand behind this line in the Talmud, forcing Jews to dig up corpses because the Zoroastrians thought that these corpses polluted the earth. Okay. I don't want to only think about persecution. I also want to think a little bit about how Judaism and especially the rabbis thought about Zoroastrianism. I wasn't there at all of the previous lecture, but I did hear a little bit about the disagreement among medieval and even later authorities about the status of a religion like Islam. this is always a central question when we think about the encounter between Judaism and other religions. So we actually have a passage that comes pretty close to weighing in on the status of Zoroastrianism from a Talmudic perspective. Now here, we have the word Magianism. That is Amgushata in the original Aramaic. That is the word that refers especially to the priesthood. And it's possible it's not talking about the religion writ large, but especially one of the central things that Zoroastrian priests did, namely recitations of sacred texts, prayers from the Avesta, those old scriptures that I mentioned earlier. And there's a disagreement between these two different important figures. Shmuel, we've already heard about. If you remember, he was dancing with cups of wine in front of King Shapur. His interlocutor, his Bar Plugta, the Amora that he's almost always arguing, Rav, also appears here. And this is what they disagree about. Neither of them say that Zoroastrianism is a monotheistic religion, is a religion that that sort of stays within the values of Judaism. Both of them think that it is problematic, but they disagree about how is it problematic. One of them says that it constitutes sorceries, and the other said that it constitutes blasphemies, right? Either way, this is a pretty severe indictment of the religion. On the other hand, and here I want to kind of transition into another way of thinking about the Jewish encounter with Zoroastrianism in the times of the Talmud. Yes, there was some persecution. Yes, the rabbis had some pretty harsh things to say about the status of Zoroastrianism, or at least Zoroastrian practice. However, there's a little bit more than meets the eye. So this piece of Talmud continues with a little bit of a complicated discussion. I don't know if we'll get to do all of it, but I do want to walk you through a little of it. That disagreement between Rav and Shmuel, it doesn't say who says what. It just says that they disagree. One says this and one says that. One says sorceries and one says blasphemies. Now, the Talmud is ever curious. The Talmud always wants to understand things to the utmost precision. And they want to know who says what. So they cite another thing that Rav said in order to eliminate one of the opinions from being attributed with Rav. Elsewhere, Rav says, he who learns something from a magus is worthy of death. That means that it can't just be sorceries. It must be blasphemies. Because sorceries, one actually is allowed to learn about in order to understand and instruct it. Therefore, it must be Shmuel who says that Zoroastrianism is sorceries, and Rav is the one who says it is blasphemies. Now, the reason why I think this is sort of takes things, the heat down a notch, first of all, it allows us to study Zoroastrianism if we go like Shmuel, because there is an allowance to learn about another religion. You can't convert to it, but you can learn about another religion as long as it's considered to be, right, not blasphemies, but sorceries. And in fact, right, that line of it comes from the pasuk in Dvarim, lo tilmad la'asot, which the pshat is, the simple meaning is, one should not practice these things. But the way the rabbis are expounding it is that you can't learn in order to do, but you can learn for edification, in order to rule on this, in order to use it in halachic discourse. Okay. Time is moving quickly, so I do want to have the opportunity to look at one key text, especially for Yom Iyun on December 25th. I don't know if you had time to... Did anyone talk about this text yet? It's a key text. This is a passage from... in the Talmud, actually, both in the Yerushalmi, the Talmud from Eretz Yisrael, and also from the Bavli, from Babylonia. But first, it starts with a line in Masechet Avodah Zarah. This, of course, is the tractate that's about idolatry. And in that tractate, there's a whole list of rules about what one is allowed to do on and in the days leading up to idolatrous holidays, right? Is one allowed to greet a celebrant of these holidays? Is one allowed to do business with them? That's all discussed in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah also gets into the nitty-gritty. The Mishnah says, what are the festivals of Gentiles that we're talking about that you have to be careful around, according to Halakha? So it lists some. These are the festivals of the Gentiles, some at the top source, the Kalends, the Saturnalia, and the Kratisim. I'm not going to go into now what these holidays are. Some of them are actually very relevant to today. But the Mishnah shows that there's interest in figuring out which holidays we're talking about. Then the Talmud, in fact, both the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli try to extend the discussion, not only to think about the holidays in the Roman Empire, which is where the Mishnah was composed, but also in Bavel. So Rabbi Ban, the name of Rav, says, three festivals are Babylonian and three festivals are Median, and lists a number of festivals that we're going to look at in further detail in just a second. There are all kinds of textual problems in trying to figure out what these holidays are, but we'll try to solve them. And then looking at the Bavli's version of this, these pagan festivals listed in the Mishnah are Roman. What are the Persian ones? There's a list of, seems like there are four now. And then there's a list of even more festivals. This text goes according to some of the manuscripts and some of the Rishonim, some of the medieval authorities. They want to know also what the rural pagan local festivals are, and they list a whole number of other ones. To sum it up, and I've kind of done a lot of the research on this, there seem to be six festivals that the Bavli, and using also the Yerushalmi, the Talmud from Eretz Yisrael, are referring to. And it's worth just going through these very quickly. There's Now Sard, a springtime New Year festival. It used to be celebrated at the equinox. There's Tiragan, which was celebrated during the summer month and dedicated to the god Tir, an Iranian god. There's Miragan, a festival in the fall that was dedicated to Mithra. There's another festival, which probably in terms of the calendar is most relevant to us today. This shows up in the Bavli as Akaniyata, perhaps it's Ahikan, and this is a late winter ancient Iranian fire festival, which to this day is known as Sadeh. And then we have two more. One is called Nowruz. It's known as the 20th of Adar, or March, in the Bavli. And finally, another holiday that's Maruz. So this is all to say that, A, of course, the rabbis in Bavel were very aware of the various holidays. They took care around them, and they engage in discussion of what these Iranian and often Zoroastrian holidays were about. I want to move on quickly and use this as an opportunity again to show that as strict as the rabbis were with Zoroastrianism, they also developed ways of living in a world where they encountered this religion. So on the one hand, something that's worth saying is, even though in the Mishnah, the Mishnah's festival from the Roman Empire, one is not allowed to engage in commerce 3 days in advance of those pagan festivals. In the Bavli, also in reference to the Zoroastrian festivals, there's a tendency to leniency. They only require one day, the day of the festival itself, that one is supposed to be careful of. In this passage right here, you see also another kind of attempt to be careful with the festivals. Look at this little source here. Ravashi was a businessman. He had a particular forest, and he sold its wood to the fire temple, the local fire temple. Right? You remember that coin with the fire altar? The main place the Zoroastrians worship is in a fire temple. He sold the wood to that. Ravina said to Ravashi, how can you do that? Isn't there a prohibition? You shall not put a stumbling block before the blind. Right, there's a halachic principle known as lifnei iver, that one is not supposed to, obviously one can't sin themselves, but one also should not do things that allow others to sin. Rav Ashi responded, most of the wood they use is for kindling, not for the ritual service. So he comes up with what we could call a kind of halachic loophole. He knows that these fire temples were places where Zoroastrians worshipped their god, and he would not be able to directly contribute wood to put in the fire, but he also knew that they had other need for wood. Maybe even most of the wood, because it costs, you need a lot of wood to heat things, was used for kindling. So because of that reason, he was able to do commerce with these Gentiles and not worry about running into problems with this prohibition. I want to end with some theological matters. This is perhaps the most interesting material to talk about. As I said earlier, the Zoroastrians were dualists. They strongly believed that the world could be divided between good and evil. There's a good God. There's a bad God. There are spiritual entities with a good God. There's demonic entities with the bad ones. The encounter between Jews and Judaism and Zoroastrianism might go as far back as the book of Isaiah, Sefer Yeshayahu. The very, very famous pasuk that many people quote incorrectly because it's a little bit different in prayer. But the essential idea is that Yeshayahu says, and he's channeling God, he's a prophet, I form light and create darkness. I make weal and woe, right? I make good and evil. This is in a section that is addressed to Cyrus, the first Achaemenid king, a Persian king, and he's emphasizing this point. I want to close with this entertaining little story that even in Talmudic times, the encounter between the rabbis and Zoroastrian dualists was still live and was still interesting. A certain Majus, Zoroastrian priest, said to a Maimar, from the waist and upwards is of Ormuz. This seems to be Ormazd, the good Zoroastrian god. From your waist and downwards is of Ahriman, the bad Zoroastrian god. A Maimar responds to him with humor, but there's also a lot of depth in this. If so, how does Ahriman let Ormuz pass urine through his land? Meaning the body is integrated. The body actually can't really be divided into two halves. One drinks something and water comes out and urine comes out after a process. So because of that, you can't divide the body and you can't divide the world into good and evil associated with Ormazd and Ahriman. Rather, we are one body, there is one world, and there is one God. And I think that's a good place to end. I think there's some time for questions as well.
Sure, yeah. If you want to take a quick look in the chat box, and then there, you can unshare your screen, and then take a quick look in the chat box.
Okay.
And
is there any order that I should...
I just go back, I guess, to Gershon, I think.
Yes. Do you think that there is any significance in the parallel between the influence of Babylonian civilization on post-exilic Judea and that of Zoroastrian Mesopotamia? Yes, I think this is a story that goes way back. That's part of why I alluded to Yeshayahu, but I don't have time to talk about it here. And the lecture was particularly on Talmud, but I have written about it, and I'm happy to share some of what I've written. The Kurdish inscription is written in Middle Persian, which was the language that the Zoroastrians used. It was a precursor of today's Farsi, of today's Persian. Let's see. Yes, I suspect Perm didn't go over well with the pagan Persian priesthood. Not necessarily true. One of the slides I wanted to share, but I didn't have time, is from a community a Jewish community in Syria, in a place called Dura Europis. There was a synagogue, a really elaborate synagogue that existed there with gorgeous panels from the 3rd century of various scenes from Tanakh, one of which is of the Purim story. And written on that in kind of graffiti is a inscription by Persians who visited, Zoroastrian Persians apparently, who visited the synagogue and said that the Jewish community showed them this Purim panel and that they liked it. So obviously the Jews had a way of presenting Purim in a way that that will be palpable to them. But yes, of course, Purim could be a problem, and maybe this is a good place to end. Rava explains the reason why we don't say Hallel on Purim, we meaning Babylonian Jews in the 4th century, is because we are still servants of Ahasuerus. He understood there was continuity between his political situation under Zoroastrian Persians and the political situation of Jews during Megillas Esther. And because of that, we can celebrate Purim, but we shouldn't say Hallel. And I think I'll end with that. It was wonderful to share Torah with you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the day learning.
Thank you very much. A pleasure. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.